The Peter Schiff Show.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Indeed. Indeed knows hiring needs to be cost-effective when you're running your own business. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply.
The secret word is stagflation. Although I guess it's not so secret anymore. There were a lot of people talking stagflation this week, particularly on Thursday and again today on Friday. Of course, I've been talking stagflation for a long time on this podcast, so it's no surprise to my listeners that stagflation is, in fact, the economic condition that we're in, except it's going to get a lot worse as far as the economy getting even weaker and inflation getting even stronger. But what really started the conversation going yesterday was the GDP report that came out for the first quarter. And the consensus estimate was 2.3%, which would have been a slowdown from the prior quarter's 3.4. So people were looking for the GDP to come in smaller, but it was a lot lower than the consensus. It came out at 1.6, which was actually just below the low end of what they were looking for. The range of estimates was a low of 1.7. to a high at 2.8. So we slid in at 1.6. But what was really problematic was when they, you know, dug into the numbers, it was the PCE, the core PCE in particular, although the personal consumption expenditures and the number actually was lower than estimates. They were looking for 2.8. It was 2.5, which was below the 3.3. So that's a slowdown in spending and GDP. But the core PCE in particular came in a bit hotter, quite a bit, and there were some revisions to January. But what's important is that the core PCE, which supposedly is the Fed's, you know, favorite measure, this is the one that's supposed to be going down towards 2, and instead it's going up in the other direction, and it's been moving up all year. And so that sent a scare through the markets. I think the Dow at one point was down maybe 600 points. Although it paired most of those gains, not, you know, by the close, and then, you know, made them up today. I mean, it was still an up week for the stock market, particularly the Nasdaq, which, you know, didn't get back all of last week's losses. Last week it got killed. I talked about that. Nasdaq was down about 5.5. It was up about 4% today. Finished with a strong gain. You know, Google had good earnings, or it was up by 10 bucks or 10%, rather, something like that. A new all-time record high. NVIDIA up 6%. Of course, it wasn't all good news. Intel was down 9.5%. But overall, you had a lot of buying in tech stocks. But I don't think they're out of the woods. I mean, I think the chart looks like there's more to this correction. So I would expect some more downside, especially as the stagflation scenario continues to play out or produce more evidence. You know, I thought it was interesting. I was watching on CNBC. They had some, you know, portfolio manager, you know, investment analyst. And the host asked her, well, how do you play stagflation? You know, what should you invest in? And I'm, you know, waiting, okay, maybe she'll say gold or gold stocks. And I'm going to get to gold stocks in a minute. But, and this is just today this came out, right? Because there was more stagflation news today that I'll get to. But they asked her, and she started talking about, well, you want to have stocks or dividend paying or income generating stocks. Then she started talking about tech stocks, and she said, well, not all tech stocks, but you want to buy certain tech stocks. So, like, as far as she's concerned, you just buy tech stocks for stagflation. I mean, when do you not buy tech stocks, right? No matter what the economic condition is, the answer is buy tech stocks, right? I mean, because she couldn't even think outside the box enough to think stagflation, maybe gold, you know, maybe gold stocks. I mean, they're the best place to be. That's one of the reasons I'm so overweighted in mining stocks, apart from the valuation, is if there is stagflation, you don't have a better economic environment because you have inflation that the Fed can't fight because you have a weak economy. So the Fed is reluctant to raise rates because it'll weaken the economy further. So the Fed is kind of, you know, has his hands tied behind its back. Plus, the weak economy widens the budget deficits, you know, and that means a weaker dollar, more money printing, more inflation. So the best possible economic scenario for gold stocks is stagflation, which, of course, is the worst economic scenario for the economy, you know, for the Fed. But unfortunately, that's what we're headed for. So the interesting thing was, even though this bad news came out on stagflation, which, of course, immediately meant that the markets dialed back their expectations for rate cuts, the dollar sold off yesterday pretty much across the board, and gold was up a bit, although gold was down on the week. I mean, gold was down almost 2%. It was down about 4% on the week because we had a big drop on Monday. Gold was down like $60. I think the reason that gold got clobbered on Monday after closing Friday at the highest close ever for a week was that the weekend went by and there was no hostilities in the Middle East. And I think because nothing happened, some people who might have bought gold as an insurance policy in case something happened, they sold. We had a sharp correction and gold dumped. I think we shook out a lot of weak short-term speculators. But 2,300 held pretty firm. And I think 2,300 is the new 2,000. I think that's really where the support is right now. The resistance is just above 2,400. So I think we're in a narrow range until we take out the highs, which I don't think the highs are going to last much longer. And I think a good indication of that is the relative strength that we had in the mining stocks. We finally had mining stocks going up with gold going down. And that's generally a good sign. When gold is corrected, which we had the whole correction in one day, but it, you know, sharp. But when you see gold going down, but the gold stocks not, it means that the selling in the miners is kind of washed out. And now they're actually starting to buy the miners. And one of the big reasons that these mining stocks are going way up is Newmont Mining came out with an earnings beat yesterday. And at one point during the day, Newmont was up about 15%. You know, one of the biggest moves I've seen, certainly that I can remember seeing, in Newmont Mining, which is the largest gold company there is, and it was up 15%. It didn't even hit a new 52-week high. I mean, that's how much the stock got beaten up this year. In fact, we're still a long way. The 52-week high in Newmont is over $50, and we're at 42. So despite that big move, but more significantly, we're up at that about 50% from where Newmont was in February, a couple months ago, 2 months ago. And on this podcast, I talked about that. That's when Newmont got downgraded from a buy to a hold, which is the Wall Street, you know, slang for sell, right? If an analyst downgrades something to a hold, he means sell it. They just don't like to say. I mean, sell is a four-letter word on Wall Street. They rarely mention it, right? But they will tell you to hold. You're supposed to read between the lines. And so this guy was telling you, this is an analyst, right? This is his job to analyze gold stocks. And so he watches Newmont Mining go way down, you know, from $50 to below $30 or 30, you know, about 30. And then he decides to say, you know what? I don't think you should buy it anymore. Let's just sell it. And his rationale for recommending selling on the low was that he didn't see much upside for gold, which was at around 2000. And I was on this podcast saying, this is ridiculous. I bought Newmont for my own account that day. And I bought it for my own account the next couple of days because it kept going down a little bit. And I just kept buying more. I thought this was a gift. And now here's the stock 50% higher, you know, than it was on that day. And I remember when I read the report, the guy said that if gold went up and their outlook changed, that they would revisit this and maybe put it back on a buy. And my point was, well, what's the point of that? Because by the time gold goes up and you raise it back to a buy, the price is going to be a lot higher. And of course, the price is a lot higher and they still haven't put a buy on it. So how much higher is it going to go before this analyst tells people who sold it at 30 to buy it back? Maybe 60, 70, I don't know. But why does this guy even have a job? I mean, all he does is analyze gold stocks and he does this bad a job. But, you know, this is generally what happens. And I said at the time, this was a great sign that Wall Street is throwing in the towel on the biggest mining company there is. And now it's had this huge gain. In fact, there's not that many stocks that have done as well. Forget about gold stocks. There's not many stocks in the S&P or the NASDAQ that have done as well as Newmont since Wall Street put a sell on it. But here's what I thought was really interesting. When Newmont initially opened, you know, with its earnings, the stock was up 5%. You know, it rallied later in the day. At that point, the GDX and the GDXJ, which are the indexes of gold miners, were negative on the day. In fact, I think there was down about 1.5%. They didn't rally in sympathy. And even though Newmont had a huge rally and the rest of the stocks were up by the close, you know, you're talking about 1% or 2% gains, whereas Newmont was up maybe 13% is where it settled. In fact, on the week, even though Newmont closed the week up 9.5% because it was down on the week before, you know, the earnings came out on Thursday. But even though Newmont closed up 9.5%, the GDX, which Newmont is a part of, it's a big part of it, was only up 1.5%. And the GDXJ, which is the juniors, which doesn't include Newmont, was only up 0.5%. Now, you would imagine that if you have a bellwether leading stock with an earnings beat, investors might buy up all the other stocks in the sector, figuring that, well, they'll have an earnings beat too. I mean, after all, it's not like gold stocks compete with each other, right? Because all the gold's the same. They're not like, you know, Mercedes and BMW. I mean, it's possible that if Mercedes sales go up, maybe people just bought Mercedes instead of BMW, right? I mean, it's generally, it could be that they just bought more cars. And so all the car companies did well, but it's possible that maybe Mercedes came out with a good promotion or a new car that just really sold. And maybe some BMW guys decided, you know, I'm going to go for a Mercedes, right? That, you know, they're more competitors. But the gold stocks, I mean, no one cares. Doesn't matter if you buy your gold from Newmont or Barrick or Agnico Eagle. It's all exactly the same. And so if one company is doing well, I mean, barring some kind of accident, right, they should all be doing well. And so you would expect when Barrick comes out with a number, oh my God, look at this. Let's buy the other stocks because they'll probably report better than expected earnings. But there was no real rush to buy the sector. I mean, people rushed to buy Newmont, but there wasn't a coattail with the rest of the gold stocks. I mean, that's how negative investors are. They're asleep. Like, they're not even bothering to figure out, okay, Newmont beat, who's next? Maybe we should buy Barrick. Maybe we should buy Agnico or whatever, because the same dynamics are likely at play. And again, why is anybody surprised that gold companies are beating with the big increase in the price of gold? Now, part of it is because they've been disappointed with gold company earnings. A lot of them have been missing. But one of the reasons they've been missing is because rising costs. They weren't getting a big enough rise in the gold price. That was, you look at all these earnings reports that were misses that we've been having for the last year or two. It was all on higher than expected costs. It wasn't that we didn't mine the gold that we thought we were going to mine. We just didn't make as much money because it costs more. And that was inflation driving up costs. But now, year to date, the price of gold has gone up faster than the cost of mining it. So now these gold stocks that were missing their earnings are going to start beating their earnings, I think. And we should have an explosive move up in these stocks. And, you know, just like I was pounding the table on this podcast on Newmont after the downgrade, I'm pounding it now, you know, if you could hear, buy these stocks, right? I mean, obviously nothing's guaranteed, but to me, they are giving them away. I can't even believe that they're still this cheap. I mean, I would be buying more, but I already bought more. I wasn't even expecting to buy more, but they gave them away. In fact, I bought more Agnico Eagle a couple of days after I bought more Newmont. And it just made a 52-week high today. And it wasn't beaten up as much, but I bought it because I thought it had bottomed out and I liked the company. But I even bought more into the index. I bought more GDX and GDXJ back on the lows, not just recently when these stocks were on the lows. But I would still buy them today, but I've got such a big position. In fact, I've never had a bigger position in gold mining stocks than the one I have right now. And I'm extremely comfortable with it. You know, I've been bullish on gold stocks before. Obviously, you've been following me. You know that. I don't know that I've ever been as bullish as I am now. I mean, I've been bullish, right? So it's not like I wasn't. And, you know, I should have sold some of these stocks and taken profits. I didn't. I just bought more. I didn't buy into the rallies, but I really didn't sell. But I bought into every decline. And I built this big portfolio personally. And I think I'm going to end up making a lot more money now when gold takes off and the gold stocks take off than I would have made if it happened 5 or 10 years ago, because I have, you know, a bigger bet, you know, on the table. I got more chips on this number that's about to come up. And so I'm going to get a bigger payday. I'm confident. But I never would have believed that gold could be at 2300, 2330, wherever it is today, and that you could still buy these stocks at the prices that they're still trading at right now. So, you know, I don't think they're going to stay this low. They're going to move, I think, very quickly. 1 week, you're going to see gold stocks up 50%, maybe more. So before Wall Street wakes up to this opportunity, take advantage of it. As long as you're, can take a risk, the upside, I think, has never been greater in relation to the downside. So now's the time, you know, go to the, you know, your Pacific Gold Fund. You can buy my fund, no load, at any of the discount brokers. You can set up a managed account at Your Pacific Asset Management, or just buy the stocks on your own. I mean, I just assume you hire me to manage your portfolio, but regardless, you know, just buy these stocks and go along for the ride. Anyway, I got a quick commercial break, so we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messages so you can contact with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agreed Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join the 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. What I love most about Indeed is how simple it makes the hiring process and allows you to do all your hiring in one place. Candidates you invite to apply are 3 times more likely to actually apply for your job than the candidates who see it in search alone, according to US Indeed data. Indeed gets you 1 step closer to the hire by immediately matching you with quality candidates. And now, listeners of my show can get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Peter. Just go to Indeed.com/Peter right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Peter. Terms and conditions apply. If you need to hire, then you need Indeed.
I was referencing the price of gold before the break. It actually settled at 2338. And I think 2300 is support now. Again, I said, I think 2300 is the new 2000. So I would buy it. I'd buy it over the weekend at Shift Gold. I'd buy silver. You don't have to wait for the markets to open. They're there over the weekend at shiftgold.com to handle your orders. But again, I think the big money is going to be made if you're willing to take a bit of a risk in these mining stocks. The expression of looking a good gift horse in a mouth really applies to the ability to buy these stocks, given, you know, how cheap they are and where gold's going to go. I just don't really see any real resistance to the price of gold going higher. You're in new territory. You're at record highs. We've just broken out of a 10-12 year resistance. We should just keep going up and up and up. And the gold stocks haven't even priced any of this in. I think they will do it violently. There will be a very rapid readjustment of price. And then, you know, you'll still be able to buy them, but just not this cheap. They're giving them away right now, in my opinion. And so take advantage of the gifts that the market gives you. The other numbers that came out today that were also problematic for the stagflation were the personal income and spending numbers for March. So personal income came out up 0.5, which was expected, but spending was up 0.8, which was hotter than expected. I mean, that matched the spending from the prior month, but it was supposed to drop to 0.6. Now, again, why are people spending more? Well, because things cost more. That's why they're spending more. They're not buying more, right? And even though these numbers are supposed to be adjusted for inflation, they're not, because you know the government numbers don't accurately capture how much inflation there actually is. I've mentioned it. You could find the old video I did back in 2013. And I should do this experiment again. Maybe I will. You know, it could be a good idea. But I just remember back then I looked at the CPI, and I noticed that it said that newspapers and magazines over the prior 10 years were up 30%. And I thought, really, they seem to be up more than that. Let me check. You know, and it's easy to check because you go on the internet. You know, we had the internet back in 2013. And I was able to look back at 2003 to see what the price of the newspapers and magazines were. You know, I took like the top 20, you know, U.S. News and World Report, Time, Newsweek, Business Week, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Washington Post. I took all the big ones. And I just looked at the prices that were written on the covers. And then I looked at the prices that were written on the same covers 10 years earlier, right? Pretty simple, right? And then I just compared today's prices to the exact same prices on the exact same newspapers 10 years earlier. It's not rocket science. And what I saw was that the prices had increased 130%, not the 30% that the government claimed from the CPI, but 130%. Now, my method was not very sophisticated. I just checked the prices. Well, I don't know what the government did, but how do you put 130% increase into the CPI and only 130% comes out the other end? Where did the other 100% go? It just disappeared, right? That is the magic of the CPI that makes inflation disappear. So that's really what's going on here, is these numbers are going up, but because of inflation. But also the core PCO, before I get to that, because spending was up more than incomes, the difference was made up for by a collapse in the savings rate, which went from 3.6% in the prior month down to 3.2%. This is the lowest savings rate, I think, in a couple of years. So this is not good news, right, that Americans are having to deplete their savings. This is bad news, right? When the economy is good, you save more. That's when you add to your rainy day fund. You have to tap into it when times are tough and you're struggling. And that's exactly what Americans are doing, is they're struggling and they're tapping into their savings in order to do it. Now, also on the stagflation, we got the PCE, which was supposed to be up 2.6 on the year over year, was up 2.7%. So again, headed further away from the Fed's 2% goal. The prior month, it was at 2.5. So if you're going from 2.5 to 2.7, how can the Fed have any confidence that we're drifting down to 2% when we're actually rising in the opposite direction? And the core year over year was up 2.8, which was better than the 2.7 or higher than what they expected, but it matched the 2.8 from the prior month. But 2.8 is a hell of a lot closer to 3 than it is to 2. Now, the month-over-month numbers were in line, up 0.3 on both the headline and the core. The reason the numbers were hotter was because of the revisions to the earlier months, but still going in the wrong direction. But, you know, one thing that's interesting, and I actually posed this question on X earlier today, but the 2% inflation target wasn't invented by the Fed until inflation was below 2%. So for years, during the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s and 1990s and even the 2000s up until 08, right? The Fed never announced that it had a 2% inflation target. Why? Well, because inflation was above 2%. So they didn't want to have a 2% target when inflation was 3 or 4, because they didn't want to do anything to actually lower the rate. All of a sudden, inflation is like 1.5, 1.1. And out of nowhere, all of a sudden, the Fed says our target is 2%. Why? Nobody asks, right? How did this happen? Congress never called the Fed and said, hey, you know, we want you to target 2%. All of a sudden, the Fed just invented this 2% target. The only reason they did that was because inflation was lower than 2%. When it was above 2%, they never wanted that target. It was only when they were below. Now, why? It was a convenient excuse to create inflation because they wanted to print money. They wanted to stimulate the economy with QE and artificially low interest rates. So they made up this pretense that, well, you know, we need 2% inflation. That's our target. And God damn it, we're only at 1%. That's really terrible. This is really dangerous territory here. We're skating close to the edge, you know, because we could slip into the dreaded deflation when we're this close to, you know, deflation here. So it was only because inflation was below 2% that they had a target. So now we're back above 2% inflation. And now they're kind of stuck with that target, right? It's like an albatross around their necks. They're never going to get it back down there because they never were able to get it back down there. They never even had the guts to try. And so now they've just kind of painted themselves in a box. Now, maybe at some point they're hoping people will forget about this 2% inflation target because they're not going to hit it, right? It was only the target when they were below it, and it wasn't really a target. It was an excuse. They wanted to create more inflation, and so they used this phony 2% target as a rationale for doing it. But again, I pointed out on this podcast where that came from. It came from the Central Bank of New Zealand, the Reserve Bank, which had a 2% ceiling. It wasn't a target, and it wasn't like, you know, try to get as close to the ceiling as possible without going over. Like, it wasn't the Price is Right. The reason there was a ceiling, it was like try to stay as far away from it as possible. So if inflation was 1, they didn't try to get closer to 2. They were glad they were at 1 and not 1.5, right? So the lower the better. The idea was just don't let it get as high as 2, even if it was a negative number. That was okay. So we took that and we turned it into this ridiculous target to justify an inflationary policy. And now we are paying the consequences of that inflationary policy. Anyway, I want to move forward and stop talking about monetary policy and talk about fiscal policy, at least a proposed fiscal policy that's in the news this week. The Biden administration is talking about tax hikes, of course, on the rich, which is basically everybody who has more money than you, right? That's how it works, right? Don't tax me, tax the person behind the tree. That's the saying. So yes, politicians get a lot of votes promising to tax other people, but not the person whose vote they want. And so they're promising just to tax the rich, right? The millionaires and the billionaires. Of course, that's what they always say. That's what they said in 1916 when they got the income tax, the 16th Amendment. It was just to tax Carnegie, Rockefeller, Vanderbilt, right? They were gonna lower taxes on the middle class, right? If we just allow this 4% tiny little tax, that was the maximum bracket, 4% on Rockefeller, right? A billionaire, right? We're gonna tax him. And the minute they got the 16th Amendment in, right? The minute that camel's nose went under the tent, they started jacking the rate up. Next thing you knew, that 4% rate was like 70, 80%. And then by the Second World War, they had the withholding tax and pretty much everybody was paying the income tax. And now, you know, you have all these middle-class people who are, you know, ensnared in this tax system. They never would have voted for it. There's no way they would have passed the 16th Amendment if the average American thought it was ever going to affect him. It was only because they were going after the rich. And that's what they're doing now with these new taxes. It's always like, okay, we're going to tax the rich. But then when there's not enough money there, you know, they redefine what rich is. And of course, inflation is going to do a lot of that for them because everyone is going to be rich with cheap money. But you're not going to really be rich because your purchasing power is not going to go up. Just the nominal amount of your income or your net worth, but you're actually not going to be richer. And in fact, with these taxes, you'll be a hell of a lot poorer. But so what Biden wants to do is he wants to raise a corporate tax back from 21 to 28%. And politicians love taxing corporations. Problem is corporations don't pay the taxes, right? They're not real. Who pays corporate taxes? Well, you got three ways for the corporation to collect the tax, because that's what they do. They collect taxes and they give it to the government because the corporation is an artificial entity, right? So where does a corporation get the money to send to the government? Well, number one, the shareholders. Who are the shareholders? Average Americans. Americans that have stocks in their pensions, in their IRAs, right? They're paying these higher corporate taxes, right? A lot of middle-class Americans have pension funds that own stocks, right? They're paying these higher corporate taxes. Then you got the employees who could pay with lower wages, right? Companies have less money, so they pay lower wages. So average workers could have a pay cut because corporations have a tax hike. And then number three, of course, is the customer, right? They can raise prices to pay the taxes. And so that's the average American, right? You big companies sell a lot of products and services that Americans buy. And if they have to pay higher taxes, well, maybe their customers are going to pay higher prices. But that's it. So it's all a lie that we're going to tax the corporation. But yeah, that sounds great because the people will vote for that. But if someone said, hey, I want to tax all the customers of the corporations, I want to tax all the employees or share. No, don't do that. So, you know, they get a lot of points. They win votes by promising to go after these evil, greedy corporations. Yeah, these evil, greedy corporations that are providing us with all the things that we like and enjoy and that make our lives better. And they're also hiring us and giving us jobs, right? Yeah, they're really evil and greedy. But anyway, so Biden wants to jack that tax up. He also wants to raise the capital gains tax up to 43%, which would be, I think, the highest capital gains tax we've had in a long time. I guess I'm okay. I'm in Puerto Rico, so it wouldn't apply to me, but it applied to everybody else. In fact, a lot of people would probably come down here if that were to become law. But obviously, a high capital gains tax like that is going to discourage investment because it's taxing capital that could otherwise finance investment. But also, the problem is going to be a lot of the increase that people have is going to be inflation. And so as inflation pushes prices higher, you end up paying a tax on a phony phantom gain. But the real problem with the cap gains tax is that Biden wants to impose a minimum 25% tax on, I think, the millionaires, billionaires, not really sure what the cutoff is. But he also wants to apply that 25% tax to unrealized gains. That's unconstitutional. I've gone over that. You can't tax an unrealized gain in the value of property as income. Income requires that you realize a gain. You don't have income on a stock or a piece of property until you sell it. If you don't sell it, it doesn't really matter what the value is. You haven't generated any income. And of course, you may never generate income. By the time you sell it, it may be at a loss. Who knows? I mean, plenty of times you buy a stock, it goes up. You don't sell it, it goes down, right? Even though you might have a gain at one time, that doesn't mean you end up with a gain. It's like going to a casino. How many times you go to a casino in Las Vegas and you're up big, but that by the time you leave, you've lost, right? I mean, there's a saying in gambling, right? Don't count your chips while you're still sitting at the table. Well, that applies to the stock market, the crypto market. All these people ought to talk about all their big gains. If they haven't realized them, they don't actually have them, right? They're still there. It's like you're at a crap table and you got all this money on the table and, you know, you're rolling the dice and you're counting all that money on the table as your gains. Maybe it's still at risk. You roll a seven, it's all gone. The money that you've made are the chips you took off the table and put in your pocket, assuming you don't reach back into your pocket and put them back, right? Maybe you're not really up in Vegas until you leave. I mean, I've seen people who won in Vegas and then they lost it back in the slot machines in the airport. So you got to get on a plane and get out of Dodge, right? Before you're actually ahead in Las Vegas. So you can't just, you know, tax people on paper gains that they may or might not ever realize. That's a property tax, right? If you tax stocks or real estate and you're saying we're going to measure the tax based on its appreciation since you bought it, that doesn't turn it into an income tax. It's still a property tax. You're just taxing it a different way. But property taxes are direct taxes. Supreme courts have held that for years. Direct taxes have to be apportioned. They've made an excuse for income taxes. 16th Amendment says income taxes can be taxed without apportionment, but it has to be an income tax. You can't just define appreciation as income and then tax it under the 16th Amendment. It doesn't pass constitutional muster. So hopefully, if they ever try this, it gets shut down. But the other part would be how destructive this tax would be economically to the economy. If you forced entrepreneurs, businessmen, people who owned private companies. I mean, it's bad enough if it's a publicly traded stock and you're forced to sell it. And some of the people, you know, like an Elon Musk or a Zuckerberg or, you know, Bezos, these guys, if they were forced to sell a huge chunk of their holdings in 1 year to pay the tax, the stock could crash, right? They wouldn't even have the big gains that were being taxed by the time they got finished selling. But if you own a private company that's not publicly traded and you have to have it appraised every year, and if some appraisers say, hey, your business is up, you know, it's worth $100 million more than it was last year, you owe a $25 million tax. What if you don't have the liquidity? How are you going to pay the tax? You're going to go into debt? Maybe you got to sell your business. You can't just sell some shares. I mean, I guess unless you're going to take on a partner or something, but you might have to sell off the whole business in order to get the money to pay the tax. I mean, it would be very destructive to the economy, to wealth creation, to production, to employment. So it would be a complete economic disaster, as well as, you know, being unconstitutional. So, I mean, the good news is these are just talking points for the election, right? So it's not going to actually happen. Now, it might happen if Biden won the election and the Democrats got the House and the Senate, then it actually might happen. But as of now, it just shows you where they stand, and they're throwing, you know, red meat to their base, which is basically socialists. That's the base of the Democratic Party. They're a bunch of socialists, right? And this is the kind of stuff that they like to hear. And so they're getting it from, you know, their leader. But it is dangerous, and I don't like the precedent of constantly talking about unconstitutional taxes and trying to redefine something that is not income so that they can stick it into the 16th Amendment and get around the apportionment provisions, which are there for a reason, because direct taxes are inherently abusive and we don't want them. The founding fathers thought that direct taxes would only be used in times of war, you know, and initially that's the only time they were used until the 16th Amendment, right? It was if there was a war, because it was difficult to apportion a tax, a direct tax. And so that's why it was there. The government was supposed to run on excise taxes, sales taxes, you know, mostly tariffs. But I told you the reason they got the income tax was they said, hey, we're going to get rid of the tariffs. We've been running on tariffs. Tariffs are paid by the average American. Maybe Trump doesn't realize that. He thinks the Chinese pay our tariffs. But in 1913, Americans were smart enough to know that we pay the tariffs. And the politicians said, hey, if we tax the billionaires with this income tax, we won't need tariffs anymore. So we'll tax these rich guys and we'll get rid of the tariffs. That's how they sold the tax to the public. And of course, now the public pays a much higher income tax than they ever would have paid in tariffs. See, that's the danger of getting into bed with the government, because you get in bed with the government, you know you're getting screwed, right? Anyway, speaking about getting screwed, I guess this is a good transition into my final topic. I want to talk a little bit more about my bank, because I finally got an answer to my last FOIA request, Freedom of Information. I did this myself on the portal. You can go and you can file a Freedom of Information Act, and the government's supposed to give you the information that you request. And so if you recall, my bank was shut down on June 30th of 2022. Out of the blue, I was waiting for the approval of the sale of the bank to Quinta, a company that was going to buy the bank, inject a lot of capital, bring a lot of talented banking, experienced bankers to Puerto Rico, really do a good job of ramping up my bank. It was a great deal for Quinta. It was good for me because at least I got out of the banking. It was great for Puerto Rico, big win for them, great for the customers of the bank, employees. It was a win for everybody. So we expected, you know, the sale to close. And out of the blue, I was blindsided by this press conference, which I put up on my YouTube channel. Just type in, you know, in YouTube, you know, Peter Schiff, OSIF, or something like that, your Pacific Bank, Peter Schiff, OSIF, and you'll see I put the press conference up on the internet. And I was blindsided out of the blue. They issued a cease and desist, no warning. And they have this press conference. And the OSIF chief says that we're shutting down Euro Pacific Bank because it's insolvent, which, you know, of course it wasn't insolvent. I probably had the most solvent bank in the world because we had no loans and no debt and millions in cash more than we owed. Now, we didn't quite have as much regulatory capital. That's why I was selling the bank, because the bank lost a lot of money because of these media allegations that it was involved in criminal activity. So that really caused the bank to hemorrhage money. We lost a lot of money. And that's the main reason I needed to sell it. And so it didn't have quite enough capital. It wasn't insolvent. But, you know, I offered to put in $7 million of additional capital back in November directly to the commissioner. We were all in the same room. And she told me not to do it, that it wasn't necessary, that we were fine. Just keep the capital at the current level and wait for the sale, because the buyers are going to put in that $7 million. That's why I offered $7 million, because they were required to put in $7 million to close the transaction. And so I put in about $2 million, you know, after that meeting I had with the commissioner in November of 2021, and the time she shut down my bank, I had added about $2 million just to make sure there was a buffer. I was protecting the clients to make sure they couldn't lose money, right? They were all protected at all times when I owned the bank. But anyway, I get out of the blue. She shuts it down, claims it's insolvent, which it's not. And of course, then she introduces this guy, Jim Lee, who is the top guy, the top criminal guy at the IRS. I'm like, what's this guy doing there? And he gets up and he talks about how my bank was actually the target of the Atlantis investigation that 60 Minutes and the New York Times and the Age wrote about. And at the time, I didn't even believe him. I couldn't even believe that my bank was actually the target. But that was the first time I found out that the media was right. I was the target. Now, the investigation had actually ended, you know, a year earlier. I didn't think I was the target. I thought I got wrapped up in it. And I knew they investigated me, but I thought it was part of a bigger investigation. Little did I know that the entire investigation was of my bank, right? The biggest investigation in the history of the world for tax evasion, money laundering, was of me, my tiny little bank in Puerto Rico with $250 million in deposits at peak, right? I was supposedly the greatest threat in the world, and it deserved this massive army of auditors, right, to look under every corner of my bank, right? But anyway, he starts talking about all the things that they suspected my bank of doing. Oh, we suspected they did this. We thought they were helping criminals evade taxes. And we suspected they were using numbered accounts so people could anonymously transfer money. And then you had the head of the Australian ATO make similar comments. In fact, the head of the British tax authority, Simon York, he came up and he said, you know, we worked with OSIF on this and we have a great result here. We're taking out a bank that was suspected of laundering money and helping people evade taxes. Everybody was careful to say, you know, we're shutting down, we're taking out a bank that was suspected of money laundering and tax evasion. Nobody said we actually did it. Everybody said that we were suspected. And the suspicion was in the past, because even though some of these guys may have suspected that my bank committed these crimes years in the past, before they investigated it, by the time my bank was shut down, the investigation had already completely exonerated the bank. They found out that all of their suspicions were unfounded and that we did absolutely nothing wrong. But they were shutting us down because they had suspected that we did something wrong. So apparently, being suspected of a crime is as bad as actually committing it. Only in this case, I wasn't even suspected anymore. I was suspected in the past. I was exonerated by the investigation, and they still wanted to punish me. They still wanted to claim credit for shutting me down. So I was, you know, curious about how did this happen, right? How did all these guys end up at this press conference? Why would they even have a press conference? Because the thing that really slipped out, and this was where they went off script, a reporter asked the head of OSIF, hey, did this bank have anything to do with tax evasion and money laundering? Did it help the customers? And then she said, no, it didn't. We didn't find any evidence of that. We're shutting down the bank, but it's got nothing to do with what any of these guys are saying, right? It's got nothing to do with tax evasion and money laundering. So what were they doing there? Why were they there if the bank was not being shut down because of their tax evasion, money laundering? And why do you spend 2 years investigating somebody for crimes, find out they didn't commit any of them, and then have a press conference to talk about how you suspected they did all these things without once admitting that actually they didn't do anything? And what's the point of having a press conference when it turns out you wasted all your time? You wasted all your money. You found nothing. So I'm like, okay, let me find out what's going on. So I sent a FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act, and I asked for all the correspondences between this guy, Jim Lee, and, you know, that related to this press conference. You know, I wanted to know, like, you know, how it was organized, how he found out about it, why he participated. You know, I just wanted all the internal emails and stuff that related to this to try to figure stuff out. So, you know, they're supposed to respond to your FOIA requests. I think it's like 2 or 3 weeks. And they kept asking for extensions. So it took me like 3 months. Right? And you have to give them the extension, right? They ask, but I mean, you got really have no choice, right? So I finally get the information and they tell me, oh, the file is too big to email it. So we're going to send it to you on a disk. And I'm like, well, can you send it to me on a flash drive? No. We're sending it on a CD. And so I get it. I don't even have a way of playing a CD. I mean, who the hell has CD drives anymore? So I bought one on Amazon. So that showed up and then it didn't really work. I didn't have the right adapter. So I had to order that. I got that. I got everything set up. I put the disc in there and I can't even read it. It's unreadable. So I had to call him back up. I said, look, I can't even read your disc. So then they put the information in the snail mail. And a week later, I get a thick package. There's 335 pages, right, that were responsive to this request. Now, what does that tell you? 335 pages. I'm asking for the correspondences that involved this press conference, this OSIF press conference. I'm asking the IRS. I'm not asking OSIF. The IRS, and there's 335 pages that relate to it. Now, here's the problem. So I'm going to show you this. This is Exhibit E. We have that. About 280 of the pages we have, we should show it up on the screen. I don't know if we're showing it because I can't tell. But we're supposed to be showing it. And I got 280 pages. You can't really see it. Oh, there it is. Yeah. So I got, and that I just took a photograph of that, so it's not great quality. But I got 200. This is page number 200. You can see the number on there. But I got like 280 pages that were completely blank. They were 100% redacted, meaning that they claimed that I couldn't even see a single word on those pages. They were privileged information. They came up with some bogus excuse why I can't see what's written there. Now, obviously, they're trying to hide something because this is about a public conference. They're talking to reporters. I have a right to see this information, but they don't want me to see it. I think because it reveals the commission of a crime. And so, you know, the IRS can commit a crime and then they can cover it up, right? Because they're the government, right? They prosecute the citizens for committing crimes, but then they get away with murder. They commit crimes all they want because they're the cops, right? And they make the rules. But I got a little bit of information that revealed a lot, what was not redacted. So here's one page that I got. This is Exhibit A. I'm going to read that, put it up on the screen. So this is an email that came from an IRS employee that was sent to Jim Lee, who is the chief who came down to Puerto Rico and spoke about all the bad things that they suspected my bank did. Now, they redacted the person who sent it and the subject matter. Why can't I see that? And they claim that it's a privacy. If you look at that B6 on the top, they're saying, well, it's a violation of privacy if I know who sent the email. The guy's an IRS employee. How does he get any privacy, right? This is part of the freedom of information. He's not entitled to privacy when it comes to this. I need to know who that guy was because I want to follow up. I want to FOIA him. I want to see who he's communicating to. But anyway, here's what he writes to the Jim Lee. Just got off a call with the blank, right? They won't let me see who they're talking to. I'm convinced it would be incredibly impactful for you to participate in an event with them in Puerto Rico in early June. I'll speak to you about it the next time we chat. Lots of coordination to do, but wanted to take your temperature on it. If you think it sounds reasonable, more to come. So they're talking about the event in June to shut down my bank. But this is April 4th, and they've already decided that they're going to shut down my bank. So that means the commissioner of OSIF decided to reject the sale to Quinta because you couldn't shut down the bank unless you rejected the sale. So she actually had made up her mind to do that before April 4th, except we didn't know it until June 30th. And in fact, for months, OSIF was acting as if the deal was still on track. They were asking us questions. We were submitting documents. I put in an extra $500,000 in capital during those 3 months when I thought the deal was still on track. Little did I know that it was secretly rejected. They had already decided to shut down my bank, which was even worse because she ended up fining us $700,000 for operating a bank without a license. Well, she let me operate without a license for those 3 months. Why didn't she tell me sooner? Right. So I would have had a smaller fine. I mean, why during those 3 months didn't she bother to tell anybody, hey, your license renewal wasn't accepted? Yeah, you filed on time and we accepted your money and we never returned it, but we secretly never extended your registration. We just didn't tell you. And by the way, we secretly rejected the sale. But also what this tells me is in mid-May, OSIF sent us a notice that they had rejected the sale, right? But of course, it had been rejected maybe a couple of months earlier. They never told us. But they said we're rejecting it after we finished the application, right? We finally gave them all the stuff that they wanted. They were asking for stuff after they had already decided not to approve the sale, right? So a complete waste of time. But they had three reasons for rejecting the sale. They were all very trivial. Our lawyer said, I can't believe that you're rejecting the sale over these concerns. Why didn't you just ask for clarification? Basically, they said that the president of the company buying the bank, his financials were in the wrong format. They needed some financials on a couple of other investors, minority investors, which were easy to supply. And there was a suspected Syrian connection involving the Quintus president, which turned out to be mistaken identity. So that was easily cleared up. And we actually cleared all that up because they invited us. They said, hey, you know, we'll reconsider our decision if you can, you know, satisfy these concerns. Of course, that was a lie. They weren't going to reconsider anything because they already made a deal with the IRS to shut down my bank and have a press conference a couple of months earlier than that. And in fact, in the cease and desist letter, they made up another reason why they claimed that they rejected the sale to Quinta. They said it was because they discovered that I was going to own 4% of the bank. And they didn't know that. They said that we told them that I would have no ties to the bank, which I knew was a lie. Because not only did I tell the commissioner in writing, even before we met in November, and it was at high up in all the documents, the purchase and sale, it was all a stock transaction. Most of my compensation was in stock. And during our conversation with the commissioner to get her blessing on the deal, which she gave us, we explained the terms and I told her why I was taking stock. I said it was because Quinta only had $10 million to allocate upfront. And so I was going to take three in cash and the rest in stock so that Quinta could put seven into the bank for the extra capital. And the commissioner said, that's great. I really appreciate your willingness to accept stock. And then she even said that she's fine if I have a bigger percent of the company than the 4% I was going to get. So the idea that we lied and told her I wasn't going to have stock is preposterous. But what I have proof of now, she claimed that that was the reason for rejecting the sale. But she actually rejected the sale 3 months prior in early April or maybe sometime in March. She didn't tell us until June 30th. But if she really rejected the sale because she found out that I was going to own 4%, why didn't she tell somebody? Why didn't somebody call us and say, hey, we just figured out there was a small print here. We didn't know this. You know, we don't want Peter Schiff to own 4% of the bank. I could have restructured the deal. I could have carried back a note. I could have found another way to make this deal happen. But I mean, who cares if I own 4%? I don't own 4% of the bank. I own 4% of a company that's now public. You know, I'm just a minority shareholder. I mean, anybody could buy stock in a publicly traded company. But it proves that that was a lie. Because she had decided to close down the bank before she came up with this excuse of the 4%. Because if it was the real reason, she would have known about it in March and would have said something. In fact, it would have been included. She came up with three reasons why they were not going to allow the sale and gave us the opportunity to overcome it. One of those reasons wasn't my 4% ownership. That wasn't mentioned until June 30th in the cease and desist. So it's obvious that the whole thing was a lie. But anyway, let me go back to more of what I got from the exhibits. So this guy sends an email to Jim Lee. And apparently he's so excited, he sends another email the same day, almost the same language, but slightly different. That's the exhibit B. Let me read this one. So this is to Jim Lee from the same unknown IRS employee. See, it says IRS CI. That's criminal enforcement. That's so he's a criminal guy. But he's obviously lower down on the totem pole than the chief. And so he writes this other letter. Just got off a call with, and then it's blanked out again. They won't let me know. I'm assuming this is either, this is OSIF that they talk to, but it could be maybe somebody from another J5 country. Hard to say for sure. For you to participate in an event with them in Puerto Rico in early June. Right. They keep talking about early June. Right? Remember, the conference didn't actually happen until June 30th. So that now they're saying early June. I'll speak to you about it the next time we chat. Lots of coordination to do, but wanted to take your temperature on it if you think it sounds reasonable. More to come. So slightly different. I mean, he's obviously like he didn't get a response. So he's like he really wants to tell the chief about this. He's really excited about this thing that's going to be happening in Puerto Rico. He's kind of careful not to actually put what the thing is, although maybe he did and they blanked that out, right? I can't really tell because so much has been redacted. I don't really know everything that was said, but I can read this little bit. And now he gets a response from Jim Lee. Jim Lee says, let's talk. I'm up for it if it makes sense, right? So obviously they have a conversation, right? So this is not going to be in writing. And that's probably where a lot of the details of the crime were discussed. But what I think happened, and it's obvious from these emails, is that somebody from the IRS contacted Puerto Rico and proposed this idea, shutting down my bank, holding a press conference, inviting the tax chiefs from the United States, the Great Britain, Australia, the Netherlands, and Canada, all together to talk about how my bank had been suspected of committing all these crimes, and complimenting OSIF, patting OSIF on the back for a great job. You're a great partner. This sends a strong message to the world that Puerto Rico will not be a haven for international tax evaders. And coincidentally, or maybe not a coincidence, 2 months earlier, in February, the IRS put Puerto Rico on a list of high-risk money laundering jurisdictions. So I think what happened is when the IRS agent approached OSIF commissioner, it was probably like, look, you know, unfortunately, you guys are on this list because it was bad news for Puerto Rico. I mean, it was hurting the whole banking industry to be on this list. And he said, look, you know, how'd you like to get off the list, right? You know, oh, really? What do I have to do? Well, shut down your Pacific Bank, right? I think this is what happened. I don't have all the proof yet. I got to dig deeper, but nothing else makes sense. I mean, the deal was on track. It was a great deal. Why would she shut down the bank? If she really cared about the customers, she would have allowed the sale. She blocked the infusion of capital, then fined it $700,000 to make it in even worse financial shape, and then appointed an incompetent receiver who had no banking experience. It's been 22 months. The bank has run up millions in bills. No one's got their money. I mean, why would this have happened? In fact, the only reason that the account got frozen for 8 months in Portugal was because everybody thought that the bank was shut down for money laundering and tax evasion, because that was the purpose of the press conference, to create that false impression. In fact, the very next day, all of the newspapers reported that my bank was shut down because of tax evasion and money laundering, even though that had nothing to do with it. Officially, the official reason was that the bank was insolvent, but the official reason was BS. And if it really was, you know, it with insufficient capital, the best way to solve it was to let Quinta buy it. And if not Quinta, someone else. I had several other people that wanted to buy the bank. She wouldn't let anybody buy the bank. In fact, I had other banks that wanted to buy the customers in Puerto Rico. She wouldn't allow that either. She wanted all the customers to leave Puerto Rico, right? Why? Because that was probably part of the deal, right? Because the whole idea was to make my bank look like it was guilty. Now, also, how I know that the early press conference was, in fact, the one that was held on June 30th, look at this Exhibit C. This is another letter to Jim Lee from an IRS agent. I mean, it's probably all the same guy, but I mean, I don't know for sure. But he's discussing the OSIF press conference in Puerto Rico. And this is the first time they actually say that the event they've been talking about is an OSIF press conference, right? Obviously, it's the press conference to shut down my bank, right? Anyway, and He writes, OSIF press conference, Puerto Rico. This event has been moved from June 7th to June 20th, now June 30th. So it was originally in early June, just like he said, but they postponed it twice and they eventually had it scheduled for June 30th. But again, this was written on May 16th. We still, you know, we're still trying to get the deal approved. We still think we have a shot at approving the deal. We don't know that they've had a secret agreement, right? Basically, I think OSIF and the IRS come to a secret agreement to shut down my bank as a publicity stunt so that they can pretend that it's guilty of the crimes that they all know it's innocent of, so the newspapers can report that the bank did all this bad stuff. Who benefited from this? There's only one group or people that benefited, and that's the newspaper in Australia, Nine Entertainment, Nick McKenzie, Charlotte Grieve, because I was suing them for defamation. And up until that point, they didn't have any proof that my bank was the target. The only proof they had was their source who illegally leaked it, and they didn't want to reveal their source. So they were stuck. They had no defense to my defamation. I don't think this is an accident. I think, and again, I don't know, but I hope the PRL approve it, but I think that maybe Nick McKenzie reached out to whoever illegally leaked him the information about the bank and said, hey, I need your help here. You know, we're left out to dry. You got to do something to implicate this bank, you know, to validate and make our allegations look true. So I think that's what happened, because who else had something to gain? And, you know, unless you think that the J5 just did it on their own to save face. But again, the only reason that they had to save face was because the story came out. You see, had the media never told this story, right? Had 60 Minutes Australia, The Age, and then the New York Times never outed Operation Atlantis, never disclosed the investigation and named not only my bank as the target, but claimed I was guilty. But they did more than just claim I was guilty. They fabricated evidence to make it look like I was guilty. They falsified their own evidence, their own results of their own investigation, strongly suggested I was innocent. But they turned everything around to deliberately and falsely pretend that their investigation suggested that I was guilty. They even wrote that my customer base read like a who's who of organized crime. I had no organized criminals. They said I helped 100 Australians evade taxes. Yet when we came down to a trial, they couldn't name one, let alone 100, right? They had no case at all. But they made the cornerstone of their case initially. They tried to make it the fact that OSIF had shut down my bank. And they tried to claim, just like the media, in fact, they did claim, because they wrote an article linking the closure of my bank to the Atlantis investigation for money laundering and tax evasion, even though it wasn't true. But the J5, the press release, the IRS press release, was designed to create the false impression that my bank was being shut down for money laundering and tax evasion. And in fact, if you look at this Exhibit D that I also have, this is also one of the ones that I got. This is written from the same IRS agent, I assume, to Jim Lee. Jim, as promised, attached are updated remarks for the OSIF press conference. While this may still change, this includes some really good language. And then there's a bunch of stuff blanked out. And I think, and then it's more blanked out, and then more blanked out. As I mentioned, I'll have more info for you in the coming days, but nothing that will affect your role. Just info to be aware of, and we will have time on the trip down to get you up to speed. Let me know if you have any questions. Thanks. So this is the guy who wrote his speech. And his whole speech, to me, I thought he was like reading right out of the Age newspaper. I mean, it was like, I thought, did Nick McKenzie write this? Right? I mean, it was all BS. And maybe this guy, who they haven't identified, is the guy who leaked either to someone at the ATO who leaked to Nick McKenzie. I don't know how many people are in the chain, but I think that all of this was done on behalf of McKenzie and Grieve so that they could get some dirt on the bank and have something to base a defense on when they had no defense. But as it turned out, it didn't work, because we were able to show that the closure of the bank was not because of tax evasion and money laundering. In fact, there was only suspicion of those things, and suspicion doesn't count as guilt. And I could point to the fact that nobody was charged with any crimes. The investigation started the day of action was in January of 2020. It's almost 5 years ago. But I found out later from bank customers that they actually started the Operation Atlantis investigation of my bank in 2018. So they started investigating me in 2018. And here it is, you know, midway through 2024. Not only did they not charge anybody at my bank, they haven't even charged a single customer. To my knowledge, not one customer out of the thousands and thousands of customers we had, not a single customer has been charged with anything. They came up completely empty. They found absolutely nothing. Yet they shut my bank down to prove that Puerto Rico is tough on money laundering and tax evasion. And also, what just happened this week, somebody from the Treasury Department came down and rewarded Puerto Rico. They took Puerto Rico off that list, the list of high-risk money laundering countries, the list that it was put on 2 months before OSIF and the IRS made a secret deal to shut down my bank. And of course, that's unconstitutional. I had no due process, no hearing. They stripped me of my property. I got zero for my bank, right? I never had an opportunity. They came up with some reasons after the fact why they were shutting it down, but that wasn't reason. The reason my bank got shut down was it was part of the deal. They had to shut it down to have the press conference. They couldn't have a press conference without shutting down my bank. If they allowed the bank to be sold to Quinta, even though that was in the best interest of everybody, especially the customers, they couldn't have held a press conference. So they had to deny the sale. So they had to make up an excuse. They couldn't tell the truth. So they made up an excuse. Then they made up another lie to put it in the receivership so that they could justify the press conference. All these guys flying down, everybody, you know, gushing all over the commissioner. She gets a huge photo op, all this PR. And now this week they come down, they say, yep, Puerto Rico is doing great. You're really cracking down on money laundering and tax evasion. And now we're going to take you off this money laundering list. The main thing they did was shut down my bank. Now, they did pass some new laws that are supposedly stricter, more capital, more compliance. My bank would have qualified on the higher quality. I would have had enough capital. You know, I had 30 people working in compliance. The requirement was like one. I think they've raised it to two or three. I had 30 compliance officers out of 65 employees. 40% of my business was compliance, right? We went above and beyond. I would say that there isn't a bank anywhere in the world that did more to prevent money laundering and tax evasion than my bank. Probably if you grabbed any bank at random and did an investigation, you would find a higher percentage of money laundering and tax evasion going on than at my bank. Yet my bank was the poster, the sacrificial lamb, right? Sacrificed on you know, so that Puerto Rico could, you know, improve its reputation. But why did Puerto Rico have to improve its reputation? Because it was dragged through the mud by 60 Minutes and by The Age and then the New York Times. That's why. Had these articles never come out, there wouldn't have been a problem for Puerto Rico. And of course, had my bank never been disclosed, Had the investigation been allowed to run its course, had the 60 Minutes, had Nick McKenzie and Charlotte Grieve not exposed this confidential investigation, named my bank as the target, and then proclaimed me innocent with lies and fraud, had they not done any of that, the investigation would have ended and nobody would have known that my bank was ever under investigation, which is the way it's supposed to be. And so why would they have had this press conference? They wouldn't have. I mean, they would have just, all right, nobody, you know, nothing here. Nobody knows we even investigated them. Nothing to be embarrassed about. We'll just move along. Turns out the bank is doing a good job. Great. You know, our suspicions were unfounded. Turns out this shift guy is pretty good. Yes, you know, he criticizes taxes and regulations, but he sure as hell abides by them. That's what they found out. The only reason any of this happened, the only reason there was a need to have a clandestine illegal deal, a quid pro quo, whatever, to shut down my bank to restore Puerto Rico's reputation on the world stage was because it was destroyed by 60 Minutes and The Age. They did the damage because when they accused me, they accused Puerto Rico. They said that I moved my bank to Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico is where I could get away with these crimes, that Puerto Rico had such lax AML standards and KYC that this is where I can get away with it. Right. So it was every bit defamatory of Puerto Rico as it was of me. So they put the commissioner in this bind. And then all of a sudden she gets on this list, which made it worse. I mean, maybe the reason she's on the list is because of these the media reports. Or maybe the IRS put her on the list so they can use it as a carrot to get them to shut down my bank so they could take her off the list. Because they put her on the list literally in February of 2022, 2 months before they somehow convince her to shut down my perfectly solvent bank that has a buyer who's going to infuse it with capital, has a new president, you know, that had quit her job at another bank. She'd already quit the other job to move to Puerto Rico to be the president of the bank that I sold. This was a rock star. She was, you know, great resume, Oxford, MIT, you know, advanced degrees, working in banking 20 years. She was going to run the bank. Instead, they appointed this guy who's never even been a teller, has no banking experience whatsoever, and they put him in charge. They had a great management team that was lined up, ready to go, lots of capital coming in, new board, everything. It was going to be a great deal. The commissioner loved the deal when I first proposed it. And so why, you know, a few months later, would she change her mind? Obviously, she saw this as an out. She saw sacrificing my bank as the best way to repair the damage that had been done to Puerto Rico's reputation by the very newspapers that had destroyed mine and was the reason the bank was having financial difficulties anyway. The only reason I was selling it was because its reputation was so destroyed by the lies and the fraud of 60 Minutes and The Age that I had no choice but to sell the bank. And then that whole thing fell apart because Puerto Rico needed to repair its own reputation. And the easiest way to do that was to win the praise of all these J5 chiefs. And how did she do that? By sacrificing my bank. But why did she do that? You know, so that the media could pretend that my bank was guilty of the crimes that everybody knew I didn't commit. And who in the world, who was the only person that had anything to gain by that? And that was Nick McKenzie, Charlotte Grieve, The Age, 60 Minutes, because they were sued and they were trying to win that defamation lawsuit and their whole case was a lie. And when this fell through, they had no defense. Their whole defense was based on this and their plan just fell apart. But the whole thing is illegal. I want to file another lawsuit down there in Australia, but I want to keep digging. I've hired an attorney, a FOIA attorney. I want to try to get more information. I want to get the stuff that's been redacted. I wish Congress would investigate the House. I mean, I know that there's a crime here that's been committed at the IRS, at the executive branch. I'd love to see an investigation. I'd love to see a congressional investigating, bring these guys up to the witness stand, you know, get them to testify, get to the bottom of why this happened. Because they, you know, the House wants to talk about the weaponization of the IRS. Well, here it is. It was weaponized against me, completely illegal. And so far they've gotten away with it. But anyway, that's it for today's podcast. I think I ended up speaking a little bit longer than I intended. I didn't know how long it was going to take me to dissect some of this information. But I think this is really important, you know, not just to the customers of the bank who still haven't got their money. Unfortunately, one of the customers committed suicide. Very nice guy. He'd been corresponding with me. I didn't really think he was going to do it, but he had talked about it or written about it. And he made sure to tell me that he didn't hold me responsible for it, you know. But it's very sad because he seemed like a really nice gentleman who had his life savings in my bank. But it's an important issue. And it's important because of the legal principles and because of the corruption that we have inside our own government. I mean, this is like banana republic stuff. This is, you know, really corrupt regimes that can get away with this. We're the cops or the criminals. That's what we've got, unfortunately, in the United States. Anyway, that's it for today. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'll be back again next week. Bye for now.